What if the most important decision affecting your lifetime earnings wasn't your career choice, educational achievements, or work ethic, but something entirely beyond your control? Three generations of the Obama family reveal this uncomfortable truth. Hussein Onyango Obama, working as a British manservant in colonial Kenya, earned 66 times less than his British employers. His son, Barack Sr., studied at Harvard when the U.S.-Kenya income gap stood at 13 to 1. By the time his grandson became president, that gap had ballooned to 30 to 1. This isn't a story about individual success. It's a story about how geography shapes destiny in ways we rarely acknowledge. Global inequality has become one of the defining challenges of our era, yet most of us struggle to grasp its true scale and implications. We see headlines about billionaires and poverty, but the deeper patterns remain invisible. Where you're born now determines your economic fate more powerfully than any other factor, creating a world where talent in Lagos faces entirely different prospects than mediocrity in London. The greatest transformation in global inequality over two centuries has been the shift from class-based to location-based inequality. In Marx's time, global inequality was driven primarily by class differences within countries, while differences between nations' average incomes were modest. By 2000, this had fundamentally reversed. Global inequality had become almost entirely, 80%, driven by location. Being born in a rich country now matters far more for lifetime income prospects than one's position within that country's income distribution. Pride and Prejudice feels like romance, but is fundamentally about economic survival. Elizabeth Bennet's family, living on $3,000 annually, occupied England's top 1%. When Mr. Darcy, earning $10,000 yearly in the top 0.1%, proposes, the stakes transcend affection. Should her father die without a male heir, Elizabeth would plummet to 40 annual income. This 100-to-1 income ratio wasn't a marriage proposal. It was an economic rescue operation. Anna Karenina's potential move from Karenin to Count Vronsky represented a tenfold lifestyle increase, from her modest origins, a staggering 150-fold jump. Transplanted to modern Britain, the gap between someone in the top 0.1%, 400,000, and someone at twice the mean income, 23,200, shrinks to 17 to 1. In highly unequal societies, wealth overwhelms love in marriage decisions. As societies equalize, genuine affection gets a fighting chance. The Gini coefficient captures inequality elegantly, ranging from 0, perfect equality, to 1, one person holds everything. Nordic countries maintain Ginis between 0.25 to 0.3. Brazil, South Africa, and Honduras exceed 0.6. The United States sits above 0.40, among the most unequal developed nations, up from 0.35 in the late 1970s. Wealth across millennia can be compared by measuring the ability to purchase human labor. As Adam Smith noted, one must be rich or poor according to the quantity of labor which he can command. Marcus Crassus's 200 million sesterces around 50 BCE could command 32,000 average Romans annual labor, enough to fill half the Colosseum. Andrew Carnegie's 1901 fortune could purchase 48,000 workers' labor. John D. Rockefeller in 1937 could hire 116,000 Americans, nearly four times Crassus's economic power. Bill Gates's 2005 fortune commanded about 75,000 workers' labor. The most striking cases emerge in developing countries. Russia's Mikhail Khodorkovsky could command 250,000 Russian workers at his 2003 peak. Mexico's Carlos Slim could hire 440,000 Mexicans with his annual income. Local economic context dramatically amplifies wealth's relative power. A billionaire in Mexico wields far greater influence than one in Switzerland. Roman inequality reveals fascinating patterns. When financial crisis struck in 33 CE, Emperor Tiberius personally distributed 100 million sesterces, comparable to modern government interventions, but from a single ruler's purse. Roman senators needed 1 million sesterces, generating annual incomes around 180,000 sesterces, roughly 500 times the average Roman's income. Rome's Gini coefficient of 41.42 matches today's United States despite vastly greater inequality at the top and virtually no middle class. Socialism achieved genuine equality. Gini coefficients in the upper 20s to lower 30s, roughly 6 to 7 points below contemporary capitalist societies. But inequality shifted from economic to political. The new class, as Yugoslav dissident Milovan Gilas termed it, Communist Party officials, enterprise directors, state-celebrated artists, military leaders, formed a bureaucratic meritocracy with considerable mobility. Benefits were tied to positions rather than income, ensuring loyalty. Losing your job meant losing all privileges. With minimal wealth accumulation possible, officials had no financial cushion after demotion. Even guaranteed employment became a weapon. Dissidents could be fired, denied other work, then imprisoned for parasitism. Elite consumption patterns deeply undermined regime legitimacy. The contradiction between socialist rhetoric and leaders' preference for Western goods, Italian shoes over Bulgarian ones, Japanese stereos over Czech ones, created visible hypocrisy. When those preaching equality clearly preferred capitalism's products, the ideology hollowed out. Communism's collapse teaches three lessons. Political arrangements can fundamentally alter income distributions, economic leveling through coercion leads to stagnation, and elite behavior must align with ideology or the system loses legitimacy. After communism's fall, inequality surged. Russia's Gini jumped from around 25 to over 40 by the mid-1990s. More than 80% of a person's global income position is determined by just two factors at birth: citizenship and parents' income class. Think of national income distributions as plaques on a pole. Your position depends largely on which plaque you're pinned to. Even substantial personal advancement on a lower plaque yields modest global gains unless the entire plaque moves up or you manage to jump ship through migration. The overlap between rich and poor countries is minimal. Only 3% of Indians have incomes higher than the poorest American percentile. This transformation undermines global class solidarity and creates enormous incentives for migration. The quickest route to economic improvement is often not education or hard work, but physically relocating to a wealthier nation. Barack Obama's mother grasped this when she sent him from Indonesia to Hawaii at 11, recognizing the chasm that separated the life chances of an American from those of an Indonesian. In highly unequal countries, the top 10% might capture 50 to 60% of national income, while the bottom 10% subsists on less than 1%, creating parallel universes within single nations. When regional inequalities dominate, wealthy regions resist fiscal transfers to poorer areas, creating tensions that can fracture nations. Migration responds rationally to vast income gaps, yet flows from poor to rich countries total just 0.05% of poor countries' populations annually. Four major pressure points exist where 3-1 income ratios meet shared borders: North Africa/Spain, Mexico/US, Albania, Macedonia/Greece/Italy, and Indonesia/Malaysia. These gaps are widening. Mexico's GDP per capita fell from 40% to 28% of U.S. levels since 1960. Foreign workers now constitute 15% of the U.S. workforce and 17% of Spain's. Survey data reveals enormous migration potential. Over 60% of Albanians and nearly 75% of Bangladeshi males would move if legally possible. The Haraga, or burners of papers, exemplify this desperation: young North African men who destroy identification documents when attempting illegal migration to Europe, preventing deportation. Hundreds die annually in crossings largely unacknowledged by either country. This creates economist Donnie Roderick's trilemma of globalization: three incompatible elements: continued globalization, huge income differences, and severely limited labor mobility. Globalization increases awareness of living conditions worldwide, which, combined with income disparities, stimulates migration. Yet rich countries create ever greater obstacles. We've built a global economy but maintained medieval borders, a contradiction that cannot hold indefinitely. Global inequality stands at a Gini coefficient of 70, staggeringly high. The richest 10% receive 56% of global income, while the poorest 10% get just 0.7%. Since the late 1980s, this has remained stable, rising within country inequality, offset by rapid growth in China and India. Some dismiss global inequality as futile without world government, yet large income gaps drive migration pressures and instability, from Somali piracy to disease outbreaks crossing borders. Our concern with justice extends beyond borders through trade, migration, and institutions like the World Bank. Cosmopolitans view all humans as having equal moral value regardless of nationality. Surprisingly, John Rawls rejected applying his difference principle globally, viewing income differences as reflecting collective preferences. Some societies choose to save more or work harder. But this ignores how colonial history, resource distribution, and global power structures shape national outcomes far beyond cultural preferences. Can we create a more equitable global system while respecting national sovereignty? How do we balance cultural self-determination with addressing extreme poverty? In a world where a child's zip code matters more than their potential, the geography of fortune isn't destiny. It's a choice we make collectively.